Hey everyone, Federico Latrop here. We've been off of the air for a minute, but Legal Latitudes is coming back and it's coming in hot. Today, I'm sitting down with the employment trial lawyer Raj Guha, a guy whose road travels through the courtroom, to the poker table, to being a biochem at UCLA, to launching his own employee civil rights firm. Raj brings strategy, the reads, and also the receipts. If you ever wondered, was my firing illegal, or is my boss just a jerk, or is this actually a hostile work environment? This episode is probably for you. We break down what actually makes a case in California, why mentorship is the cheat code for young lawyers, the real costs of starting a firm, and how employers can prevent lawsuits by doing the right thing. This episode is going to be practical, candid, and it's all about protecting people. Because on this show, we don't just talk law, we talk about lives. I am Federico, and this is Legal Latitudes. Let's get into it.
Okay, Mr. Raj Guha, thank you for being here with me today. This episode is going to be useful, exciting, and I'm sure it's going to come with a lot of practical tips for everybody who's listening, because you deal with something that everybody has dealt with, which
That's
is
right.
being an employee, right? Mm-hmm. At a certain point in your life, you're going to be an employee, most likely.
That's right.
But before we get into the nitty-gritty of employment litigation and tips for anyone who's dealing with an abusive boss, let's talk about your background a little bit. You're originally from India, right?
That's right. Yeah, and I'd like to thank you as well for having me. It's always a pleasure to meet with you, Ferry. Mm-hmm. I'm from India. Yeah, I was born in India.
Nice. So you were born in India, and at what age did you move to California?
I was 2 years old, I believe, right around that.
Okay. Do you remember anything? No, you don't remember anything.
Nah, I was too young to remember anything. Definitely my earliest memories are already in the States.
Okay, so everything that you know about India during those times, you have received it vicariously through your parents, right?
Well, we would go back fairly often to visit. Yeah, you know, probably, if not every year, definitely every 2 years, until I was in, say, middle school, junior high. But I think that's still a fair statement. More about stories and movies and that type of thing.
Do you have like a feeling, do you feel your roots are very powerful and you feel identified with the culture still?
Yeah, absolutely. I sort of was raised halfway between two worlds, or maybe in a combination of two worlds, but certainly my Indian identity is a big part of who I am.
Awesome. And then what made your parents move from India to the United States? I assume there are opportunities, right? More opportunities in this country. But specifically, what made your parents say, okay, we're going to go? We're going to leave everything behind, or we're going to go?
Yeah, I mean, it was a big decision. They literally moved across the world, straight to the other side. So it's never easy. I'll never know how hard they had it to relocate and leave behind everything they knew. But and certainly, I think it was, when I asked my parents, they say there wasn't as much, you know, the economy in India was not good at the time. But we were lucky because my dad's older brother had already moved here and to Southern California and, you know, had a good job and was able to help us all get green cards, which, you know, not every immigrant has that luxury, you know. And so yeah, it wasn't easy, but we made it.
So your dad was a sibling of how many?
Dad, let's see, one, two, five.
Five siblings.
Yeah.
And your family, is it a big family as well? Do you have several siblings?
I have one younger brother, but that's it. I don't have any children of my own yet, knock on wood one day. But my brother has a niece, or I have a niece, and my brother has a daughter.
Okay.
So.
So, and then they moved to the U.S., and where do you grow up?
We grew up, I Well, I grew up in Los Angeles County, in the Pomona area until I was in sixth grade. Mm-hmm. And then we moved down to Orange County, and I was in Orange County through high school.
Okay. So was it always in the back of your head, was it instilled by your parents that you wanted to be a lawyer, or all of a sudden you made that decision?
It was the furthest thing from my imagination when I was in high school or even college. I'm sure it's a very common story with Indian immigrants. My parents wanted me to be a doctor. They really immersed me in science education, the maths and the sciences, the STEM field, they call it now, right? And throughout my early education. And I went to UCLA, actually, as a biochemistry major. I actually really loved classical music. I used to play the piano and the viola. I haven't played in too long, you know, that was a big part of my life. And for a time, I thought that I wanted to be a orchestral musician, actually. Wow. It was the furthest thing. I you know, I was good at the sciences, but I really liked art and history more. At some point, I think that my love for history lined up with the law in some way, and that's something. But I didn't really know what I wanted to do in the law until after I started law school.
Right. So you basically had like an abstract idea of this is my path, and that decision was made in high school or college?
In college, I tried a lot of different things. I was almost triple majoring at one point. So I did my science education, did music on the side. I also ended up as a political science major. But I took a break during my undergraduate studies and started playing poker for a living.
How long were you playing poker?
Probably 7 years. Wow. 7-8 years. That's all I did. I took a break from college, and I was doing SAT tutoring. And I took up poker sort of as a random hobby. Nobody in my family ever gambled or anything like that. I was really attracted to the strategy of it. And over time, I found that, you know, that was a better job in every way than tutoring high school kids, which is what I did through college.
So when you're playing poker, I mean, doing it as a living, necessarily you need to be in Vegas playing poker, or were you doing it in LA? What's the dynamic behind? Excuse me my ignorance.
No, not at all. I mean, a lot of people ask me questions about it. I think I began playing poker right around the time that the online poker boom in the early 2000s was happening. So for the first time in history, not only could you play in Vegas, but a lot of people don't know it in terms of, you know, brick and mortar casinos, brick and mortar card houses, I should say. Southern California has more poker real estate than anywhere in the world. You can't have regular casinos in Southern California for the most part, but you can have card clubs. So poker is a big part of the, you know, scene in Southern California. And over the last, and then online poker became wildly popular, and people probably remember in the States, at least, that when all of a sudden ESPN was flooded with poker programming. So during that time, I started playing online, and also would travel throughout the States, played in Miami, Philadelphia.
And you say we travel with your family, or?
Oh, no, I had, occasionally I had friends, but most of the time it's more of a solitary pursuit. I sort of traveled to where my, you know,
were you fancy making good money?
I mean, it was not anything compared to what I make as a lawyer, but I lived pretty comfortably, and, you know, was able to save some money that helped me get in, you know, that I used to pay my way through law school.
And so this was early 2000s.
Oh, let's see. Yeah, I would have started playing something like 2004, 2005. Okay. I think.
Yeah, you were young, so still making young money playing poker, it's like living the dream, no?
That's certainly, through my 20s, it was great, right. You know? And Yeah, it allowed me to travel more than I ever had. I, you know, for the vast majority of my life, for better or for worse, I never worked for anyone. You know, I did work, like I said, for a couple of companies doing tutoring, but then I started doing that on my own. And poker really was where gave me a lot of independence. I didn't get rich doing it. Some people have. I wasn't really on that sort of echelon, top up echelon. But I will say that I learned how to grind out a comfortable existence.
Right. You need to keep that, you know, quiet, because nobody's going to invite you to play poker as a friendly game. Huh? You're going to steal all their money.
That would be smart. It's not even,
So if we play poker, most likely you're going to take all my money from me, right?
Well, you know, I wouldn't play poker with my friends unless it's for very, you know, just for fun.
I would be interested to play poker with you. Yeah, that would be. I didn't know that about you. You know, we've been spending a lot of time together, and I didn't know that you played that.
Oh, I never talked to you about it.
No, never. That's very interesting. So eventually you decide to go to law school, right?
Yes. I just, at some point, poker became, you know, I went back to law school after my three highest earning years in playing poker. And the reason is because it was repetitive. Mm-hmm. I find I've heard the same stories from day traders. So it's like, regardless of the amount of money you're making, if every day you're just doing the same thing, and no matter how good at you are at it, if ultimately it's not something that, first of all, it's repetitive, and it's also not something that I felt was constructive. I felt that I wanted a purpose. I wanted a connection to my society. And, you know, playing at a poker table all day is, you know, fine, but not really constructive.
So now you're a trial lawyer, right? Mm. Fast forward. And I assume that there are certain techniques that you apply in terms of psychology, the bluffing, it's a classic thing, you know, that comes from poker, that we do now as trial lawyers. And how would you connect those two? Are there, you know, can you link them, or not really? They have nothing to do with each other.
Well, I think that poker is a metaphor for a lot of things in life. It's transferable to many different fields, and can be used to model very interesting things, war games and whatnot. But absolutely, I mean, I can't overstate how much I feel that my life as a poker player, my ability to be disciplined about managing long-term objectives against short-term risk, how to read people, you know, understand cues in communication, nonverbal cues,
right?
Which, oh my God, I mean, in terms of controlling a witness in a deposition, or, you know, understanding where the jury's at in jury selection, these are absolutely critical skills that build on the ability to read a poker player across the table when they are bluffing, or know when they have a very strong hand.
So you consider yourself a good people reader?
I would say so. I think that overall, I think that term emotional intelligence is probably overused. But yeah, I do think that in general, I'm able to assess where the emotional state of the person I'm communicating with. And also then to understand that the critical thing in poker is also to understand how your action affects that person's emotional state, how what you do takes them from one place to another, and the ability to anticipate that and react real time. I mean, it's just as important in client intake as it is in the litigation process. Certainly also one's ability to... It's just as important in the practice of law as in the business of law, I would say.
Yeah, because, you know, doing what we do, we need to have empathy, right? And sometimes, we were just talking about this, sometimes a client comes with a case and they are maybe hiding some facts, but you like the client, you like what the client is telling you. And sometimes we tend to forgive certain things that will cause us to spend a lot of time, a lot of money and effort, and ultimately perhaps lose the case, because we were not reading the person well. We didn't know at the time we were doing the intake that this person was hiding something very important from us, just because they were afraid that we were not going to take the case, right?
Yeah.
And yeah, that's a big asset, I think, being a lawyer, especially a trial lawyer, where you have to read not only the jury, the other side's expert, but also your own clients sometimes, right?
All right. All of that's, I think, perfectly said. You know, it's such a difficult thing to predict how your client will testify 2 years from now when they're sitting across from you for the first time,
or, right,
you know, you're talking to them on a phone call. And you have to, I think all of us, you know, all attorneys, but especially individual plaintiff's attorneys, people who fight for the little guy. I mean, we must be able to quickly assess our clients' strengths and weaknesses so that we can help them.
Right.
Sometimes, you know, our desire to help them must be tempered by a realistic appraisal of the risks or weaknesses of their case. Mm-hmm. And we have to have that tough conversation with the client.
Right.
And that skill is an understanding when and where to make those moves that affect the outcome of the litigation. It's a critical thing.
Right. So what I tell my clients, and you probably have your own strategies and techniques on how to deal with them at the beginning. But what I always tell them is, I can deal with anything that comes with your case as long as I know the truth. The only thing I cannot deal with is with a lie coming from you to me. So that's like the only unforgivable thing in the relationship that I build with my client. Because sometimes there is a privilege, right, between the client and you as a lawyer. And the client is not used to dealing with people that have, because you don't have a robe like a doctor. You go to the doctor and you tell the doctor everything because you don't want to get misdiagnosed.
Right.
It should be the same with your lawyer.
It's so important. Oh my goodness. What a critical, simple, obvious, but gosh, so critical,
right,
concept that, look, please, your lawyer is somebody who is trying to help you. The attorney-client privilege is, as far as I know, the strongest privilege,
right,
in our system of law. I mean, it's the one privilege that cannot be waived, at least by the attorney.
Mm-hmm.
And so, God, like, you must trust that your attorney can prepare if they know the truth.
Right.
But if the one thing, if you do not tell your attorney the truth, then, gosh.
Then the first person to tell you that truth is going to be the other attorney in front of the jury, maybe, or at the position that they're taking of your same client.
Nobody's perfect.
Right.
Nobody's perfect, you know? And you don't need to be without flaws or never made a mistake to deserve help.
Right.
You know? And so, the trust, without trust, you know, this will not work. And if there is trust, you can get through almost anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Trust and time to prepare. Don't.
Yeah.
Don't surprise me. Trust
that information at us last minute.
Exactly.
Give us some time. So you start in law, and when is it that you decide that you want to do employment litigation as opposed to? Because let's go back a little bit more. Because being a lawyer, you can be many things, right? You can go work for a big corporation.
Yeah.
You can do in-house. You can do tax. You can do so much. And then you decide to be a trial lawyer, right? A personal injury or employment litigation lawyer. We kind of like hang out with each other and deal with the same issues, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Although you're an employment litigation lawyer.
Yeah.
And I'm a personal injury lawyer, but we deal with people.
People.
So I guess my question is two ways. So the first one is, when do you decide to go into litigation as opposed to the other options out there?
Huh. Well, I think I had a immediate attraction, sort of a romantic ideal about fighting for justice and individuals against the powerful. And I think while I was attracted to employment law broadly, I could have also at some point seen my, at least in law school, seen myself as a criminal defense attorney or, you know, maybe some do practicing some other area of civil rights. But I think that, or perhaps labor law, union law, you know, so there's a lot of different avenues. But I would say the litigation, well, I should say, after, throughout law school, my major focus was on workers' rights, broadly speaking.
Okay.
You know, through a human rights lens, through nonprofit vehicles, I was open to all of it. In fact, after I graduated, I worked at a nonprofit for about a year and a half.
Okay.
Not doing any kind of litigation, so just doing... you know, non-litigation advocacy through through a human rights lens. But that job, I was laid off, and I made a decision that I was never going to work for anybody again. I just knew that I needed to have the freedom to explore and figure out what my niche would be rather than... trying to fit a mold somebody else had created. I'll put it that way. So I came back to California. Actually, the same week I was laid off, my dad was hospitalized. He's recovered and all that. But, you know, it's, you know, the universe was telling me to come back home.
Where were you?
I was in Florida, actually, at the time. I went to law school at Rutgers in Jersey. Mm-hmm. And then took my first job in Florida. And, you know... I wasn't immediately sure that I wanted to, you know, litigate, that I even, as you said, there's many different ways to use your law degree, even if it's not in the law per se. I briefly thought about, look, if I want to litigate, it's going to be as a solo. And if I decide to open up my own law firm, that's going to be sort of the rest of my life. Is this really what I want? Thought about it for a few months. And then, you know, hung up a virtual shingle, you know, started a website and, you know, and, but there was no question at that time.
Right
that
out, I was, out of law school.
I suppose so, a couple years, but certainly with no litigation experience, mm-hmm. no idea where my cases were going to come from, right. Or, you know, had some savings, but not enough, it turned out. So, you know.
Quite the risk taker, huh?
I didn't realize how deep of a pool I was diving in at the time. But I knew I loved the field. It gave me a lot of meaning. And I had one friend from who I graduated from the same high school, same high school class. And he had been doing it for about 15 years. And he really encouraged me that I was making the right decision, that since I loved the field, that I had what it took. Turns out it was a real... You know, it was like trying to, I've never been river rafting, but I imagine it's something like that. Just hung on and I'm still here.
So let's talk about the challenges, because you've been doing great. You've been investing on your law firm. Now you started doing a little bit of marketing here and there. You're a successful lawyer and there is no dispute. You know, that's undisputable truth too. So... There were challenges at the beginning. What are those challenges that you had to face with no experience opening your own firm, virtual or whatever, other than the money, right?
Yeah. I mean, it is very important to be realistic about the financing necessary to start a law firm. Advertising is not easy. It's not cheap. And staff in California especially are very expensive. And... there's just a ton of costs that you don't really understand when you start out. You don't understand how expensive it is to take a case to trial or how expensive it could be. It's very difficult to do all of that when you're also worrying about the money.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I knew I had some savings, but, you know, I reached a funding bottleneck and had to lean on a few resources. Luckily, I had them, but everything was stretched to the limit, and credit cards all maxed out when my first payday came through. So I would just say But all that, right? I think you can figure out all that. There are funders now. I didn't know about then, but I know about now. There are litigation funders ready to finance firms who know what they're doing and just need liquidity. The real piece of advice I would give to any law student who wants to open up their own firm right out of law school is, first and foremost, you can do it. But make that decision that you want to do that early in law school, and then develop the mentorship relationships, that the mentor relationships that you're going to depend on. Mentorship is the single most critical resource to a young lawyer, and I think sorely lacking in our profession and in many professions. I mean, it's a tough field.
Right.
It's tough enough to survive.
Yeah.
When are the best supports to also teach, right?
Yeah.
So I see the struggle, but yeah, mentorship is the name of the game. And if you have that, then you'll know who to go to when you have questions. When a case gets big and you need help, you'll have people to bring in, right? So that's the biggest thing. I would encourage any law student who's thinking about it, you have what it takes. If you're thinking about it, you probably have what it takes.
Right.
But you're going to need help. Realize that and build that community early.
Start building it before you make the decision, so that whenever you have to lean into someone or you need to answer questions, right, that are gonna come, you have someone to talk to and receive support in any way possible. Because, for example, when you open your firm, you have so many vendors out there. How overwhelming it is to decide what litigation software we're going to use.
Oh.
That, to me, it took me a long time. And I don't know if I made the right decision, but I'm already made that decision. And once you make it, it's hard to go back. And without giving any names or specifics, we're using the same company helping us to improve that decision we both make. I don't know how happy you are with your decision. I'm starting to fix it, you know. But maybe if I had asked someone that had a little bit of experience, I would have made another decision. And yeah.
Need a trial lawyer who will fight for you? Call Lathrop Law Firm at 760-723-9612 or visit www.lathroplawfirm.com.
It's true. Every vendor will tell you that they have the key to making your firm the next infinity dollar firm, you know. And that doesn't mean anyone's acting in bad faith. I don't mean to suggest that at all. It's just that, there's a lot of competing companies.
Mm-hmm.
They're evolving at a unprecedented rate. I thought it was a helpful concept. Somebody told me, and I'm, shamelessly stealing the line here. I think they said that when you buy into a software product, you're really investing in the development team.
Mm-hmm.
You're investing in their ability to innovate and
make
all the connections necessary in their field to continue to allow your firm to stay on the cutting edge.
Right, because nowadays it's so dynamic.
Oh my God, so everything's evolving crazy. AI.
So the way I would say is, it's like, if you want to invest or buy a Rivian truck, and remember, I wanted to buy a Rivian truck, like the first settlement I get, I want to get a Rivian because I really like it. And my friend was like, dude, be careful because they are not doing well. And they're going to plummet down. So it's like, okay, that decision of buying a vehicle, maybe it doesn't depend on how the company does, but it's still important, right? Now, even more important, when you're finding a vendor that is going to work with you for the rest of your days, perhaps, right?
Perhaps.
You don't want to be obsolete.
Right.
You want to keep evolving as the other, vendors out there, and be cutting edge all the time. So just to say it in simple is, find someone that really invests on innovation, right?
Absolutely.
On being always the first one out there. Yeah, that's a great tip, Raj. And you started doing employment litigation, right?
That's right. So I do. I've recently reorganized my firm into the Employee Civil Rights Group, so that's what I do. Employee Civil Rights. I represent individuals with discrimination, harassment, and retaliation claims against big companies, but also public entities, counties, mm-hmm. you know, agencies, stuff like that.
Nice. So that's something we started talking about this in the beginning of this podcast. Employment cases, when you get the cases, is at the end of the process, right? Things start happening in a certain way. And people sometimes, employees, don't know their rights.
Absolutely.
And it's so important that they are informed as to what they deserve, what their rights are. So what are ways of them knowing, if they are listening, for example, what are their rights and how to make sure that their employer is not doing something against the law?
Well, my strong belief is that companies have some of the best lawyers out there,
right.
Armies of them,
mm-hmm.
and employees deserve the same.
Right.
Employees deserve counsel, not just when they've been fired, but also whenever they need help understanding what their rights are. I believe passionately that one of the most important roles that plaintiffs' employment firms like mine play is the role of educating
mm-hmm.
potential clients and just more generally the public. I have often in my career, of course, you know, most employment claims involve some sort of wrongful termination. There are some important subcategories where that's not true. But typically, most employment lawsuits involve a termination.
Okay.
But it's very important that employees have counsel well before a termination happens when their rights appear to be threatened. So my first piece of advice is reach out to a lawyer as soon as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's the other part is keep good records.
Okay, so let's touch on the most common employment litigation cases that you probably see, and correct me if I'm wrong because I'm no specialist, but wrongful termination, one of them, hostile work environment, another one, right?
That's
so
true.
So if you're wrongfully terminated, what are the steps? What are the things other than getting an attorney, someone that believes was wrongfully terminated? What's a case that comes to you and it's a better case rather than one that maybe wasn't, you know?
That's a very good question. And I'll try to keep my answer concise.
Okay.
'Cause there's lots written on that, lots to say. Terminations, getting fired sucks.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And there's always a component where it's like, I did my best and I was not recognized. That does not, however, mean that every termination that hurts is a wrongful termination. We sympathize with everyone that's been fired, but many cases are not where that feel wrongful are not wrongful under the law.
Right.
Right. In order to have a case for wrongful termination, well, let me back up and say the vast majority of wrongful termination claims are retaliation based.
Mm-hmm.
That is, the employee made some kind of complaint usually,
mm-hmm.
and then they get fired because they made that complaint.
Like whistleblower type of
case. Great example, okay. Right? So in California, we have a very strong whistleblower statute, a state whistleblower statute. It's called Labor Code Section 1102.5. That statute protects anyone who makes any report or refuses to engage in any kind of unlawful activity.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, we see a lot of cases where someone says, hey, the employer is doing something illegal, or maybe there's something unsafe that's a violation of the health and safety laws. you know, or maybe there's some discrimination and you make a complaint about that discrimination. And then that company that's already been doing something wrong just doubles down, right? And decides to fire the person who's become a troublemaker.
Right.
Yeah, that's a very, very common wrongful, retaliation-based wrongful termination narrative. Another one, but that's not all, there's not always a complaint. Sometimes we see employees who requested some medical leave.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the middle of leave, they might get fired. Or right after they come back, maybe they're demoted.
Right.
And then fired. We see that a lot. And another category is like age. Somebody's been working at a company for, you know, many years. And then the company just makes the decision they want to bring in a fresh, new, cheaper workforce. And they push out the older worker and replace them with a much younger worker.
Right.
Oftentimes, those employees don't even know what hit them. Everything was going fine. And all of a sudden, they're just gone. So those are really heartbreaking cases, but and can be very, very powerful legal claims.
Mm-hmm. And then what about a hostile work environment? Because I think there are a lot of myths or misconceptions that people have in general that they believe that are not really true, right? They tend to believe they have a case, whereas it's not that easy. It's not like your boss is an asshole that immediately makes a hostile work environment right. lawsuit, right?
Common
so what are those myths that you can clarify today?
Wow, what a great question. I wish this was better communicated to everyone, right? Mm-hmm. People need to understand this so they can act on their rights. A hostile work environment sounds like, hey, someone's being mean to me at work.
Right.
Now, that's part of what makes a hostile work environment, but it's not enough. If your boss is a bully, and I won't use any bad words because people are listening, but let's say if your boss is an equal opportunity jerk,
mm-hmm.
right? Well, that's actually most often nearly a total defense against a discrimination claim, because discrimination means you're treating me different.
Right.
You're treating me worse. Right. So if your boss is mean to everybody, you might probably you don't have a hostile work environment claim, which is very confusing.
Right. Because right? The word hostile work environment claim just tells you the environment needs to be hostile. But what you're saying is that the hostility needs to come out of discrimination.
Right.
So it should be called a discriminatory hostile work environment, right?
That might be helpful. I think so. The concept is you have to show basically that the harassment, the bad treatment is directed at you. You're being singled out right. because of who you are.
Protected.
Because you're a member of a protected class, yes. for example, right? right? So California has some of the most, probably the most expansive list of protected classes in the state's employee civil rights statute. Race, age, color, national origin, gender, mm-hmm. Sexual orientation, excuse me, and many, a host of other characters, veteran status, disability. So there's many, many categories, but you got to find one.
Right.
That is the reason for the discrimination, or in this case, hostile work environment is a type of harassment, right? So let's give an example, I think, mm-hmm. that would help. Your boss uses the N-word,
mm-hmm.
okay? That is a type of harassment based on race, right? That's easy to understand. And in fact, no employee in the state of California should have to work, or our laws say it's unlawful for any employer to create a work environment where that type of racial harassment is allowed, right? So that hostile work environment might affect not only let's say black employees, but other employees as well,
right?
So that's sort of where, and you might have somebody who just makes a racist joke, and that person is not bullying or yelling or anything that it might sound hostile when you first think about it, but that might, that racist joke might qualify, you know, if it's severe enough, might create a hostile work environment.
And in that situation, while the behavior is racist, but you are not part of the protected class, do you still have, because based on what you just said, other people that are not members of the class could have also a claim just because the action was against a protected class, right?
So, yes, and it is possible. Oftentimes under California law, what you said is true. Under federal law, it's different.
Okay.
And we're getting now into sort of the nitty-gritty that really depends on the facts of your case.
Mm-hmm.
And if one believes that that type of activity has been going on, you got to call a lawyer.
Right.
You got to call a lawyer. Keep track of it. Mm-hmm. Take notes when it happened.
Right.
Keep a written record. And then supply that record to your attorney as soon as possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to ask you about federal preemption, but I will leave that out of the podcast because I think people are going to start, you know, getting bored with lawyer talk.
Yeah. Basically, California...
The first
I can answer that quickly, right? You know, federal employment law, that's called Title VII. The federal employment civil rights law called Title VII applies in almost all states. It also applies in California, but California has the right to go above that, and it does. It offers much greater protections through the state laws.
Got it. So it's not federal law is not contradicting. It's just California supplementing in areas that federal law doesn't work.
That's right.
Doesn't apply.
You got it.
Okay, great. So let's talk a little bit about your cases without, of course, revealing any confidential information. But I think it's been a couple of great years for you, right? You have had big corporations on the other side of the table, either negotiating. You've been going to trials, right?
You know, I haven't made it to trial yet, personally. Okay. I've gotten very, very close. And we thought we were going to go to trial against a big company earlier this year, and that case resolved just before trial. So, we do expect to be, you know, heading to trial several times in the next year, though.
Right.
So we're always preparing for trial.
Right.
Is the short answer.
We all want to go to trial, right? Like, I mean, at least the lawyers that I surround myself with, they all like the trial work and experience. It's like what I feel passionate about and what ignites this passion about the practice of law. At the same time, we're business owners, so we need to take care of that side, which in part takes away our time and makes us juggle so much, right? How's been for you that experience of being a business owner and then also trying to keep up with being a trial lawyer?
Yeah, there's a conflict. There's a, not a conflict, I should say, there's a tension.
Right.
There's a tension between being the owner of the business as well as the product of the business, mm-hmm. right? It's not impossible to do, but I've learned that they are separate functions. And in order to succeed, you have to nurture both.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, your question was, what were some of the difficulties? Or
For you, personally, you know, how have you juggled this tension between being a trial lawyer, doing the lawyer work per se, versus being a business owner that takes away? Because you, same as me, you've been receiving some mentoring, right, from Jen Gore.
Jen Gore is my business coach.
You're the one who basically brought me into hiring her, and I thank you for that because it's been great for me.
Wonderful, wonderful.
And I don't know if I'm wrong here, but I see her to be very passionate about the business side of being a lawyer, you know?
Absolutely.
Managing the lawyers and building this empire.
Yeah.
To me, that's interesting, but I also want to keep doing my lawyer, boring lawyer work, you know. And I see that you're somewhat similar to me in that sense.
Yeah, we're definitely kindred spirits, like all of that, I think. Because, yeah, it's very important. One cannot serve one's clients if one's firm is not strong, successful.
Right.
And if the lawyers at the firm are tired and overextended and don't have the support they need, if the support staff does not feel that they have what they need to succeed,
right.
It's not going to last. Yeah. It's not going to last, and the client will not be served. And so Jen has been just, I cannot say enough good things and explain how grateful I am, because I have a lot of very important mentors in the litigation game,
right,
who are trying to make me better at the craft of being a trial lawyer. But at the same time, understanding the business of law, and how to strengthen your firm's footprint.
Right.
It amplifies all of the lawyer work that we do.
Mm-hmm.
Another important concept is that as the firm grows, as the firm's capacity grows, as staff are trained and systems synergize,
right,
it frees up the trial attorneys,
right,
to do the creative work that they want to do.
It lets you pick for once. Like, all of a sudden, from doing everything, you're just picking what you do better.
Well, you can't do everything, right?
Right.
I mean, if you're doing everything, you're just doing the most urgent thing. That means you're not planning. You're not moving forward on your long-term projects.
Right.
You're only putting out short-term fires, which means you're probably putting out the same fire again and again.
Yeah.
Right. So bringing an eye to the business immediately forces you to take a long-term planning perspective, among other things.
And for us, you know, lawyers, it comes natural to receive mentorship from other lawyers in the trial area.
Right.
But it doesn't come as natural when it comes to business, right?
None of us went to law school to be businessmen,
right,
or business people.
Yeah.
Right.
So this idea of having a mentor giving you business advice on how to deal with your business is something that I never thought I was going to do.
Mm.
And I don't think many people do, but I also
not
highly
enough.
Recommend it.
Yeah.
I highly recommend it.
I couldn't echo that more.
Yeah.
It's very important.
Good. So, we've been going for over an hour, but we're getting close to an hour, but Raj, to close, what are tips that you could give to employers, you know, because ultimately when we get involved as lawyers, we are resolving something bad that happened.
Mm.
And what I told a client of mine the other day was, justice is not perfect. We have money as in the way of, you know, providing back what was taken away from that person. And if we could do something that is better than that, is to go back in time and avoid those things from happening. So how can we use this opportunity to provide that advice or give some tips to the employer so that they do what's right? And, you know, this is going to maybe take some clients out of your future clients out of your plate, but still, what comes to mind in that sense?
I love how you frame that, Freddie. I mean, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure always. And, you know, our goal is to make our clients' lives better. And it would have been better if they hadn't gotten screwed, you know?
Yeah.
So, but I do, the more I do this work, I do gain more and more respect for, I think, the vast majority of companies who do have good systems. So,
do the right thing.
Right. You know, and take seriously the need to give disabled employees accommodations and not retaliate if an employee needs some medical leave. You know, I think the vast majority of companies do the right thing because, you know, they may have made some mistakes at the beginning, but our legal system does quickly sort of penalize them for those mistakes if they are in good faith. But too often what we see happen is something a little bit different. I mean, I think a very common dynamic in the economy today is consolidation, sort of vertical consolidation. There's fewer and fewer companies doing in each industry, right? And those companies are looking to cut costs at all times. And many of them just don't care. They don't care about, you know, if about putting profits over people, just to simplify it. And so they don't care about how many lawsuits they have to face. They're going to keep pressuring employees until they get sick. And then when they get sick, they're going to discard them. And they make a lot of money doing it. They make a lot of money doing it.
Well, we deal with these insurance companies not paying what clients deserve. And that's why we have a job. I always tell my client, my clients in general, why do you need me? Well, you need me because these guys are not doing what's right. If everybody did what's right, we wouldn't be here. And at the same time, you know, while we're not in the legislature, we're a prior episode, I talked about this with Jesse Crisp. We are some sort of police, you know, because we are building society, we're making changes. And you guys in employment litigation cases, you have punitive damages.
That's right.
Last night I was talking to an attorney from San Diego, Sean Simpson, and he wrote this book on punitive damages. And it's about, you know, overcoming all of these myths behind punitive damages. And those are the damages that shape society, because while one of the damages that is like compensatory damages, they compensate what was taken away from the person.
Right.
Punitive damages punish the bad actors out there. So it's very important that us as lawyers try to claim those damages and pursue those claims to make the bad actors accountable.
I agree. And you know, it's really only by using that system of fines, you know, and I love what you said about, I think you said something very close to we're policemen, right?
Right. Yeah,
we're prosecutors, right? We're like the DAs.
Right.
We're prosecuting our clients' claims.
Yeah, on the civil side.
The civil side, yeah. So, that's why, you know, all of what we do is civil rights law.
Right.
Whether you're in personal injury or what they traditionally call civil rights or doing employee civil rights. I mean, we are here to protect the rights that, outside of the criminal realm, the rights that protect people against big, powerful conglomerations of capital.
Yeah.
You know?
And it's so amazing that we can do that, you know, because in other countries, lawyers like us, they don't exist just because the system don't allow them to exist.
There are many things that are, one could say, there are many things that are properly critical and should be said about the American justice system. But I'm very proud to practice in a country, the only country I think in the world, if I'm right, but that has a Sixth Amendment constitutional right to a jury trial in civil cases. Because, you know, I don't care how powerful or rich somebody gets or a company gets, you know, 12 people or 8 people or 6 people can hold them accountable. I'm grateful to do this.
Yeah, and I'm interested also into, you know, when I go back to Chile and I talk to my lawyer friends down there, they have some push against the jury trial system in a way that they think, well, these guys are not specialized in what they are deciding, right? But there are so many controls and barriers prior to what they need to decide, like motion for summary judgment, you know, all of these things that like, okay, the law... As the law allows this claim to move forward for the jury to decide, okay, now it's time for them to decide as to the damages, as to liability, as to who was at fault here, right? And who needs to pay.
Right.
But for a case to get there, it passes through so many controls, and it's not easy to get to a jury trial.
No doubt.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So yeah, with that, Raj, thank you so much. That was
a pleasure. Thank you for
Thank you for being with me. That was a great episode. Raj, there is so much to talk with you, and I'm sure that our listeners would have feedback as to what are the topics that were most interesting during this conversation. So if you're listening, feel free to reach out. Raj, if they want to get in touch with you, how can they reach you?
Well, my firm's website is www.employeecivilrightsgroup.com. And my email is just raj@employeecivilrightsgroup.com. So
R-A-G?
R-A-J.
R-A-J. Okay. Yeah. Awesome. Thank you.
All right. What a pleasure. Thanks, Fede.